Full Bio is our book series where we fully explore a deeply researched biography over the course of a week, day by day, so we can get into the details. Bob Spitz's new book about one of the most successful bands in music history is called Led Zeppelin, The Biography, and it comes in at a whopping 688 pages. Over the course of Led Zeppelin's 12-year career as a quartet, it is a story of musical genius, star power, tragedy, money, hubris, misogyny, and addiction. Today we learn how the young blokes from the UK decided on a name, got a record deal, and broke through in the United States, but somehow could not get a foothold in their homeland. Here's today's Full Bio conversation with Bob Spitz about Led Zeppelin, The Biography. We talked a lot about the band, Bob, but I want to talk about some of the people behind the scenes because they become very, very important in the story of Led Zeppelin. Specifically, let's start with Peter Grant. He's the band's, I'm going to say, infamous manager.
Infamous, right, yes.
That's the right word?
Yep.
How did Peter Grant become part of what we know as Led Zeppelin?
Peter Grant had worked for a guy named Don Arden. Don Arden was, we'll use your word, Allison, infamous. He was an infamous manager in the UK. He brought artists from the States to perform in the UK for the first time, like Gene Vincent, like Chuck Berry, and he never paid them. He'd just say, tough, I'll break your arms if you complain. Don Arden, by the way, became Ozzy Osbourne's father-in-law later on. He didn't pay Ozzy either. But Peter Grant worked for Don Arden. He was a road manager. And so he was an early road manager for Chuck Berry, for Gene Vincent, for Little Richard when they came to the UK. And he was a good road manager. He took care of them. Whenever promoters refused to pay them, Peter would make sure they got their money because Peter weighed about 300 pounds. He was a wrestler, and I will use this word, he was a thug as well. If Peter felt that he had to use force to get something from somebody, he was not at all bashful about, you know, using force, whatever force he had available to him at the time. So he was well-versed with being on the road. He knew the rock and roll lifestyle, and he was perfect for Led Zeppelin.
So they're this brand new band. Before they were Led Zeppelin, they tried to be called the New Yardbirds.
Yeah,
right. That didn't work out. The rumor was, though, it was another famous musician who gave them or led them to Led Zeppelin as the name. How so?
Ah, yes. Well, there was a very famous session on an early Jeff Beck album called Truth, one of the most important albums of the 1960s. And after the session, and on that session was Jimmy Page, Keith Moon, John Entwistle from The Who, Jeff Beck, and a few, John Paul Jones actually too played on that. And after they were done, they thought, you know, maybe we should form a band on our own. The guys from The Who would leave The Who, and Jimmy would and John Paul would join them, and they'd go out and somebody, I think it was Keith Moon, who said, yeah, that'd go down like a Led Zeppelin. Nobody thought anything of that at the time. And when it was time, almost 3 years later, to form this new band, the New Yardbirds, and they were looking for a better name, Jimmy had one in reserve, and it just stuck.
How did they appease the family of Count Ferdinand von Zeppelin, the German inventor and industrialist who developed and popularized the Zeppelin airships in the early 20th century, 1910 or so?
Right. They never appeased them, actually. Von Zeppelin's family was furious that anybody would put the name Zeppelin on an album. And sent several cease and desist letters to Peter Grant. When they were playing in Denmark, however, they invited the Countess von Zeppelin And everybody, you know, charmed this woman. They went out of their way, and she bought the whole thing. And as she was leaving the session with the band, it was a meet and greet that they did before one of the shows. Somebody made the mistake of leaving the album cover out. She had never seen the album cover. And of course, it was a Zeppelin going down in flames. And that started her fury all over again.
My guest is Bob Spitz. We're talking about Led Zeppelin, the biography. It's our choice for full bio. Well, let's get to how they got to become a recording act, how they went from being a band of blokes in the UK to actually getting signed to a record label. How did a band break through back then in the late 60s?
Well, breaking through is one thing, but getting a record deal was another. Mm-hmm. And getting a record deal was really difficult in those days. There were only really three major labels in the UK, and none of them were really interested in the new Yardbirds. So they did what they knew they had to do. They took it to the United States. And the minute that Atlantic Records heard that Jimmy Page was involved, they said, we'll sign this band without ever hearing them. Jerry Wexler, who was the head of A&R, a renowned head of A&R, he had, you know, developed the sound of Aretha Franklin. He had recorded, you know, Wilson Pickett, Ray Charles. He believed that great bands were always built around one phenomenon. And he knew that Jimmy Page was a phenomenon. And so he bought them sight unseen and gave them a great deal. So that was easy. But launching Led Zeppelin was another thing. And they came at a really fortuitous time. It was really the birth of progressive radio, FM radio. And so a new band could really be heard on FM radio, let's say on a Thursday. And if they were playing somewhere on a Saturday, there would be lines around the block because all the kids in the States took their cues from what they were hearing on FM radio. And that's basically what happened with Led Zeppelin.
When Led Zeppelin was at its peak musically, when they were really, really at their best, what did each member bring to the band that led them to that, to them being their best musically? What did each person bring?
Wonderful question. Jimmy Page brought riffs. Jimmy was not a songwriter. Jimmy wrote guitar riffs that he embroidered together. And that's why there are so many different rhythm changes in Led Zeppelin's music, because they're not old fashioned type songs. They're riffs that were crocheted together for songs. So Jimmy brought riffs. Robert Plant brought a fabulous set of pipes, rock and roll voice that really took Jimmy's riffs and projected them in a different way. And he gave us great lyrics as well. John Paul Jones was the bedrock of that band. John Paul Jones could play anything, and his bass and his keyboards and the recorder that he played on Stairway to Heaven gave Led Zeppelin their own unique sound. And John Bonham, and I will tell you this, I'm not a drummer aficionado, but for me, John Bonham was the primo musician in that band. When you put headphones on and listen to him, and I'm a musician, I don't know how he played what he played. I mean, his wrists were amazing. He had an incredible sense of timing. I've never heard a guy play triplets with his feet on the bass drums. And so, you know, he was the motor behind that band. And that's what they each brought. And I think it's, you know, they were unique in their own ways. And they found a way to bring it all together in those songs.
You write that kids in the front rows of the shows ducked the first time they heard the opening number, Good Times, Bad Times. They were known for being really, really loud. Why was this such an issue?
It was really one of the first bands that cranked the volume up to 14 instead of 10. And it shocked these kids. They had never heard anything like it before. Jimmy Page knew that you weren't just going to listen to Led Zeppelin, you're going to feel them as well. It was the type of music that he had in his head. And there was a way that he heard it projected. It was completely new. Nobody had ever played that music that loud in an arena or in the beginning in these coffee houses and small facilities that they played in. And it shocked kids. I know that Ann Wilson told me when she and her sister Nancy, who later formed Heart, went to hear Led Zeppelin the first time, they were so overwhelmed by the feeling, by the loudness of it, that they had to leave halfway through. They just in order to process it. They had never had that experience before. And what Led Zeppelin was really giving these kids was an experience.
There's this great tidbit in the book about the introduction of the Marshall amp and how it was integral to their success. First of all, who was Jim Marshall? And how did what he decided to do impact Led Zeppelin?
Yeah, let's begin with the amps. I guess the loudest anybody had ever heard a band before was when the Beatles played Shea Stadium. Now, if you go to see any video of that, you'll see that they dragged their little Vox amps out. I mean, the kind that I used to use when I played in my high school gymnasium. That's all bands were playing through in those days. Jim Marshall changed all that. Jim Marshall ran a record shop. He was a drummer and he ran a record shop in North London. And people like Pete Townsend and Jimi Hendrix, who were just getting started in their careers, would come in and say, you know, we can't make sound loud enough for our music. We can't project it. The amps just didn't do the job. So Jim Marshall decided that he was going to give these kids something that they wanted. And he redefined how an amplifier is made with bigger speakers and bigger speakers and bigger speakers. Every time he built one that was big enough, somebody would come in and say, we need it even bigger. And it was Jimi Hendrix who realized that you could take 2, 3, 4 Marshalls and link them together. So if you put them on stage, you would have 4 times the sound. And of course, that gave us arena rock eventually.
It's interesting that you talk about arena rock because Jimmy Page were adamant that they weren't metal. I'll tell you, I was reading this book and somebody leaned over to me and said, I'm a guitar player. Those guys, they were some of the best thieves ever. They stole everybody's R&B. So if they're not metal, they're not technically R&B, how were they described and how did they kind of get away with repurposing other people's work?
Well, first of all, I mean, look, Jimmy said they weren't heavy metal. You know, you can call them anything you want, progressive, heavy metal. They all apply to them. They really do. Look, what they did was they took these fabulous blues songs and they hotwired them, you know, with the new amplifiers, with the new fuzz boxes, and they brought a new sound to it. At the same time, they could have credited these blues guys for the music that they were adapting, but they didn't often. I mean, perfect case. A Whole Lot of Love is almost note for note a Willie Dixon song. Willie wrote it in the 40s, and Robert changed some of the lyrics. And Jimmy always said later, "Gee, I thought Robert would change the lyrics a little more," but it wouldn't have mattered. It was an identical track as well. So they thought, okay, these blues guys had music handed down, and they adapted it. We'll just adapt it too. But they didn't credit them. They slapped their names on these songs, and so "Whole Lotta Love" was written by Page and Plant instead of Willie Dixon. Later, the courts corrected that, and they wound up crediting these guys. But they borrowed from R&B, like everybody's borrowed music over the centuries, and put their own spin on it.
My guest is Bob Spitz. We're talking about his book, Led Zeppelin, the biography. It is our choice for full bio this month. When the band started touring the United States and their music came out, one might think they had a sort of a hero's send-off from their home country, and that people in the United States might be skeptical. It was the other way around. Why was that?
Yeah, there was no place for them to play in the UK. They couldn't connect with their audience. There were no arenas in the UK, no purpose-built buildings for concerts, no big auditoriums that would play rock and roll. So they have to play in pubs or in little coffee houses, and they really couldn't develop any kind of a momentum with their career. So Peter Grant said, "I know where their audience is. We'll go to the United States." I mean, they could play in every college. They could play at all the big facilities that were made for music, and places later on, like the Garden and Madison Square Garden, or Boston Gardens, or the Fillmore, of course. In New York and in San Francisco. And so they realized that they could really get their careers off the ground and make some money and play in front of a lot of number of people, many people in the United States. And they toured the United States again and again and again. And of course, that built up a resentment in the UK. And so they felt that this was a band that the people in the UK, the kids, felt that this was a band who had abandoned them. And they had a lukewarm reception back at home.
That was today's full bio conversation with Bob Spitz about Led Zeppelin, the biography. Tomorrow, we'll talk about the dark part of the band's history, its treatment of women, and its descent into drug use.